Committee on Health Care to order. Couple announcements. We will be carrying over until Thursday Senate Bill 591A, Senate Bill 34A, and Senate Bill 145A. And we will hear all those on Thursday. We're awaiting amendments and further discussions on those three bills. And then with that, we will open a work session on Senate Bill 163A. Sandy, would you give us an update, please?
Madam Vice Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 163A, as you recall, permits the exchange of protected health information between health service organizations and the state health plan for the purposes of providing integrated behavioral and or physical health services to clients, has an emergency clause, is effective upon passage. There's no fiscal or revenue impact at this time. What you have in your packet, I believe, should be the A3s and the 2s. The A3s build upon the A2s, so I'm not sure if we'll really need the A2s at this time, but they both came out very close to the same time, so we put them all in your packet. And also, Madam Chair, I'd like to acknowledge some testimony that you also have in your packet from NAMI, a piece of written testimony on Senate Bill 163 that we'd like to acknowledge for the record. And Representative Gelser and possibly Cindy Becker may want to start discussions on 163 with the amendment.
So thank you, Sandy. I'm scanning the NAMI letter.
Mm-hmm.
What is their... I'm just trying to understand there.
I think it was just a commentary. It's not necessarily a position of support or opposition. They're just putting the perspective of issues from the organization as a whole. And as you can see, this went to Representative Tomei, and she forwarded it on to us.
Right, so
it didn't come to the committee directly. It's just more as a informational document.
Okay. Thank you very much, Sandy. And so maybe some explanation on the amendments would be in order. So would that be Cindy? That would be great. And I believe one of these amendments is Representative Gelser's.
Actually, my understanding is both of them are. I had submitted a request for the A2s. Representative Gelser had some other concerns and submitted a request, thus generating the A3s.
Thank you. Representative Maurer.
Well, Representative Gelser stepped out, and we've had a conversation about this, and hopefully we can answer all the questions that are going to come up regarding the A3s, which I think are the ones that we will be looking at.
Okay. Cindy, do you have any comments about the amendments?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Cindy Becker, and I'm the Executive Director of COHO. Thank you for the opportunity to speak about the amendments. And Representative Gelser and I exchanged, where'd she go? Correspondence.
Outside for a moment.
And also, I know she had talked with Representative Maurer, and I've talked with the Department of Human Services, which you may want them to come up as well.
Right. Thank you.
Yeah. What we did is we knew that the committee's concern was an open-ended sharing of information. And so what this amendment seeks to do is give specific information that may be shared. This information is currently reported to the Department of Human Services by the fully capitated health plans and by the mental health organizations. So it's not creating any new information. This is what is in their contracts and termed as minimum data set, encounter data set. So this was, all parties felt that this was critical information that could be shared. And then Representative Gelser and Representative Maurer also wanted Section 3 added, which does speak to an acknowledgement, a written acknowledgement by the individual that this information may be shared. They do not have to consent to it being shared. They just have to acknowledge that they received information that it might be shared. And I've spoken with the Department of Human Services and and they can also speak to this, but they have agreed to modify the existing disclosure statement that clients sign when they enroll in the Oregon Health Plan, and they would have this information in it and would then receive, the person would be signing that in part and parcel with the entire disclosure statement, which is part of the enrollment application.
Chair Kotek, members of the committee, my name is Wally Schaefer. I'm the medical director for the Division of Medical Assistance Programs, and I will just confirm what the testimony that Cindy Becker just provided and say that the Department of Human Services is supportive of the amendments. The list of items that can be disclosed without authorization is the list that the managed care organizations would rightly have and rightly want to exchange. In Section 3, the requirement to change the information that enrollees get is actually a good idea. It helps clarify what the applicants are, what can be done with their information without specific authorization. We have already actually started a process with our communications unit to look at what would be required, and the benefits of the way the current version is worded is that we don't have to actually change the application, which we're trying to shorten. So all of this additional wording would be part of the information booklet that the Oregon Health Plan applicants would read and would acknowledge that they've read. And the application basically is a signature that they have received that information. Once they are deemed to be eligible after that application, then they're enrolled in managed care organizations. So the managed care organizations will know that they've seen this information once they're actual accepted applicants to the OHP. So we think that the current wording clarifies what information can be exchanged without specific authorization, and it looks good.
Thank you, Dr. Schaefer, and thank you, Representative Gelser and Maurer, for working on this. Did you want to say something, Representative Gelser?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I really appreciated the help in coming up with some language that would work for everyone, and just for the record, it's my hope. I know that some of these issues are going to be defined in rule, but particularly around F and K, that diagnosis and medication prescription and monitoring, I certainly hope that the intent is followed, that that is kept to a minimal amount of information that is exchanged without a patient's consent, and that whether a person is on the Oregon Health Plan or a private health plan, privacy of medical information is very important, and I would also hope that in every circumstance, providers would be seeking to get consent from people to the degree that's possible, and I hope that in the next legislative session we can address some of the issues that came up in terms of really how wide open it appears to be that any provider that's treated a person either now or any time in their past could exchange things like clinic notes and progress notes. So I hope we can come back and revisit that in the future. But for now, I think this will help with more efficient billing and management if it is limited to these minimum data set issues here. Thank you. Representative
Mao? Thank you. A comment.
I saw something forming on your lips.
Well, I was just her, Representative Gelser's last statement about revisiting some of these issues about sharing of information, I think, opens up a completely different can of worms than this bill. But I like what it says here. I think it's something that is good. And it's not inconsistent with current practices, but it does provide the patient or prospective patient even further disclosure, so which is a good thing.
Thank you, Representative. Madam Chair. It might be an issue in the interim that we might have to address with this committee.
Yes. And as a matter of clarification, I would be much more comfortable if current law looked something more like this than what we heard in our Health Policy Committee during the testimony. So that's what I was looking towards.
Well, I look forward to that further conversation in the interim. I think it opens up a lot of new lines of discussion. But Dr. Schaefer, in terms of defining things in rule, that's going to be doable. And
Chair Kotek, members of the committee, yes, that will be doable. I wasn't completely clear on which items needed further definition, but particularly the diagnosis and medication prescription and monitoring can be further defined in rule. And I think the legislative intent is clear that information is not to be exchanged without specific authorization unless it's really appropriate and needed. And so the definitions and the rules should reflect that.
And the sensitive nature of particular items. And I believe we all received notice of rulemaking, but I don't know if we can make sure that this particular set of rulemakings, at least to the members who have been most interested in this, or maybe the entire committee, because we can see what you're suggesting when the rulemaking comes down. That would be helpful.
Okay. That sounds good.
Other questions? Representative Gelsel?
Madam Chair, I'd move the -3 amendments to Senate Bill 163.
Thank you. Representative Gelsel has moved the -A3s to Senate Bill 163. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, so moved. Representative Gelsel?
Madam Chair, I would move Senate Bill 163 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Representative. The motion is to move Senate Bill 163 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Aaron, could you call the roll?
Aye.
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 Thank you, Aaron. And with that, the bill is on to the floor. Representative Gelsel or Maurer, either one of you like to carry this? Representative Gelsel, carry that to the floor. Thank you so much. And thank you, everyone, for the work on the bill. It's been long in coming, and thank you for your patience. And with that, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 163A.
Thank you very much, Madam Vice Chair.
My pleasure, Mr. Chair.
I do appreciate that. I do in a moment want to talk a little bit about Senate Bill 145, although we won't be moving it until Thursday. But in the meantime, let's open up a work session on Senate Bill 337A. Sandy?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 337, you'll recall, modifies provisions and requirements relating to the notice of a professional negligence claim to a health professional regulatory board and to subsequent actions of the board. It specifies that reporting requirements continue to apply to a public body if the public body is substituted in place of an insured as a defendant in a claim of alleged professional negligence. This was a work group product, Senate Bill 337. We've heard from the members of that work group. You'll recall Senator Bates was here last week on the 22nd. You do have, at that time we talked about the A4 amendments, which you'll recall made a slight change on page 3, lines 4 and 5. There was also discussion about some consistency of language, thus generating the amendments, which are the A6s. And my understanding is, the way I've engrossed the bill,
A5? You said A4s. Did you mean A5?
No, we had the A4s, sir. I'm not... The A5s. I'm not sure if we talked about that. Did we talk about the A5s at the last meeting? I didn't have any notes that reflected that. This was a conflict amendment. I'm sorry. It is the conflict amendment about the conflict between Senate Bill 83 and the definition of impaired versus a licensee with an impairment. So we do need the A5s. That is a conflict amendment. As of last week, we haven't revised any of the conflict checks with current language, but if need be, we would get that. The A6s, at the request of the chair, mirror the language from on page 3, subsection 5A, and then subsection B on 11. The reference on line 6 of subsection 5A talks about may not publicly post any information about the claim if the disposition of the claim does not result in a money judgment, an award, or settlement that involves a payment to the claimant. We mirrored the language from subsection B to say a judicial finding or an admission of liability, which is the language down in 5B, lines 13. We added that up in line 6, and then we took the language money judgment and award or settlement that involves a payment to a claimant and added that to line 13 so that those two subsections mirror each other in language. And as long as that meets the intent of what we were looking for, that's what's before you.
Mr. Chair, could you or Sandy read the way it would look engrossed, unless we have an engrossed version, just that
does it look
entire
like
clause?
Well, and I did a quick engross, and they placed it a little differently. So line 6 would read with the A4s, if the committee adopted the A4s, starting on line 4. A board that receives a report of a claim.
I don't have A4s. I don't know. It's very similar. Let me find it.
Okay.
That was one of the first ones.
All right. I have A4s.
And you've written it in here. That is your A4
line.
Right.
Okay.
A board that receives a report of a claim under this section, and we're changing it to say, may not publicly post, deleting the first section of line 5, starting with any information about the claim if the disposition of the claim does not result in a judicial finding or an admission of liability or a money judgment, an award or settlement that involves a payment to a claimant. The remainder of 5A stays the same. Starting with...
Is this it? 6 is not. There they are. Okay.
Then on line 13, the sentence would read the same. A judicial finding or an admission of liability or a money judgment, an award, or a settlement that involves a payment to the claimant. So that the language in subsection B is the same as A.
You can verify that that's the case, but that's the intent at that point.
And then we did define judicial finding. For the purposes of the bill. I'm not sure why he added that, because that's in there.
Madam Chair, it's because, if I just may opine, it would be because a judicial finding could be in favor or against.
Okay.
So if you don't define it as a finding of liability, there could be a judicial finding that nobody did anything wrong, and it would still have to be reported because it's a judicial finding.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. Another question down there?
So, Mr. Chair, may I just clarify what I'm understanding this? And so the 5A says you can't post anything unless there is a money judgment, an award, a settlement, a judicial finding. Basically, if there's no real finding, you can't post anything. B talks about if there was a finding of all these, one of these types of findings, then they can publish it?
No, the B has to do with the circumstances under which they can disclose information about the claim. And this says they can't do it except under the same circumstances that they could post it up above. One is about publicly posting, the other is about disclosing. We were told that if they could publicly post the fact that a claim had been made, but they could only, under this section, under B, disclose information, I call it to ask about the claim. We can only disclose information if a narrower condition, a judicial finding or an admission of liability. So there are two different things, but one of them has to do with public posting, the other has to do with disclosing information about the claim, and the conditions under which they can do either of those will be the same if the amendment got it right.
Mr. Chair, I'm challenging whether or not the amendment got it right.
That's a different question.
Because it seems to me that we were meant to add this additional wording on line 15, not line 13.
You should find the emission line.
Because you put it up above, and now you still have lines 14 and 15, which says a board may not publicly disclose or publish any allegation or factual assertion included in the claim unless the complaint resulted in a judicial finding or admission liability. I thought it was at that point.
Yeah, that is at that point.
So
it's actually probably at all 3 points.
Maybe so.
But they probably could be combined perhaps into a single. No, they need to be separate because there's more in it. But you're right. It is at...
Resulted in...
It may need to be at 13 and at 15.
Line 1 after the word A.
Sandy.
And I.
You and I need to talk to the... Representative Gelser, yes.
Yes, I was just wondering if Senator Bates...
And Gwen, you want to come up as well?
I just wondered if Senator Bates had seen the A6 amendments and if we had gotten any feedback from him.
No.
On those.
Had not. But I can't imagine there'd be any problem with it.
Mr. Chair, could we possibly also get feedback from BME?
Yeah, well, did you say Gwen Davis wanted to have some conversation on this?
Yeah.
I'm Gwen Dayton.
If you need her.
Do we need you?
I'm happy to Chair Greenfield, I'm happy to go through what I think these amendments do if that would be useful.
Sure. Why not?
Thank you. For the record, I'm Gwen Dayton. I'm the Executive Vice President and General Counsel for the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, and thank you to the committee for continuing to consider this bill. Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, here's how I read the Dash 6 amendments. They do indeed make A and B, paragraphs A and B, parallel to one another, with the exception that you were just referencing. Okay, and I think this one of the most helpful things to me as I think about what the impact of this is that A talks about what the Board of Medical Examiners or other licensing boards can post or disclose. B talks about what is disclosed once that posting occurs. So under the Dash 6 amendments, a board that receives a claim shall keep the claim confidential, or if you adopt the Dash 4s, not publicly post. I know that makes the conversation confusing, but assuming passage of the Dash 4s, may not publicly post information about a claim if the disposition of the claim doesn't result in either a judicial finding or admission of liability, that's the addition in the Dash 6, or in a money judgment, award, or settlement, payment, basically, for the claim. So under A, the board can not publicly post something on their website that didn't involve either a finding of or admission of liability or a payment. And typically, if you have no payment, you have no finding or admission of liability. So those two typically are together. But under the Dash 4s, the board could then disclose upon request to somebody called and said, I don't see any claims against this physician, for example, but could you have some that you have not posted? That's available upon request. That's the point of the Dash 4s. So then you go to B and say, if the board discloses information about a claim that's subject to report, so if they do A, the board shall indicate in the disclosure, so in the posting or upon request, whether the claim resulted in a judicial finding or admission of liability, or under the Dash 6, or I think it's and, whether there was any kind of payment involved. So when a person looks at something on the website or when they call the Board of Medical Examiners, they're told those things. Under the Dash 6, a board cannot disclose the underlying factual allegations unless there was a finding or admission of liability. If there was no finding or admission of liability but there was a payment, under the Dash 6 there wouldn't be that disclosure of the underlying facts because there was no finding or admission of liability.
That is where we wanted the amendment. They have it in the wrong place. We wanted the amendment in line 15. Rather than in line 13. All right. Thank you very much.
Sure.
BME? Taylor, you want to talk about this? Is this going to cause you any problem if we get the dash sevens right?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kathleen Haley, the Executive Director for the Board of Medical Examiners. No, I think if we get the dash sevens right, we'll be all together.
Okay. Thank you very much. Yes.
Mr. Chair, question. Why, and I think, Kathleen, you'd be a good person to answer this, why is this section construed in such a way that it's all about what the board may not post rather than what the board is required to post? You see what I'm saying? There's nothing, and I don't think the committee ought to be under any illusions that because a doctor has triggered one of these conditions, it's necessarily going to be posted. Because I don't read it that way. It's saying that you can't post under certain conditions, but not that they necessarily will post under other conditions. So help me through that.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Cannon, this was what was worked out in our work group. Right now, the board is posting everything that we get and making available to the public. But where there hasn't been any money judgment, there is some feeling that the physician is unfairly then posted for the public viewing.
Mr. Chair.
And this addresses that, sub A.
Right. Thank you. And I understand that. But it doesn't address what might be at least a hypothetical concern, and I'm raising it now, that the board wouldn't continue to act as you've acted, which it sounds like is on the side of posting more rather than less. There's nothing about this statute, and I just think the committee should be clear, this is a policy decision here. There's nothing about this statute that will compel the board to disclose anything. It will simply compel the board not to disclose certain types of information. So we just need to, I think, understand that.
May I? Mr. Chair?
Please.
I think it's an excellent point, so maybe I'll ask this
question.
We're
in a work session, so.
Does it say in statute that you should post certain things anywhere? I mean, it might not be in here, but is there anywhere where it tells you that you should be posting certain things?
Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair Kotek, no.
Thank you.
I think we very specifically need to get to this in the interim. I mean, I think that's where the whole question of what's posted and what's not. And I think you read this exactly right. It started with a negative. So they need to keep it confidential, and this uses a different word. It says may not publicly post, which means that they don't need to keep it confidential. And then I think if we get the other cleared up, I think we have a standard set of things that say when they can do something, but it doesn't say when they must. And I think that's the larger question that we addressed with an earlier bill, is that what is the proper amount of disclosure, going all the way from the bars, we disclose everything, every complaint, however crutchy it was, to we don't tell you anything unless somebody enforces us to. And the answer's got to be more toward the bar than up here, I think.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
If that, just going along with what has been said by Representative Cannon, it would be easy for the amendments to say, instead of may not publicly post unless there's these things, it would say they shall post if there has been a money judgment, award, settlement involving the payment to the claim, to a claimant.
Well, this bill came together with a fairly large work group that was involved in it, and I'm afraid at this late date, that's a pretty serious unraveling of it.
Of course, none of the people on the work group represent
the public. No, and I think we need to take that seriously.
Okay.
I think this bill may not be the time to do it. It just may unravel things in a way that it's too late in the session to unravel. We should have had it earlier. Representative Bonamici?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure I want to make my comment now.
Oh, go ahead.
But I was going to ask if there was an objection to taking out the double negative in 5A and saying shall publish if, and taking out the double negative. It shall not publish unless, if there is not.
Let's get OMA in here and the hospital association.
If you're doing it anyway, right?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Bonamici, we are doing it anyway. There isn't any objection from the board.
Thank you.
Grant, will you? Thank you.
you again for the record. This is Gwen Dayton with the Hospital Association. Brief consultation. We don't have any problem with crafting something that says shall post in these circumstances and shall not post in these circumstances. If the committee is interested, I'm more than happy to have a go at drafting something like that this afternoon and tonight and submit it to my colleagues and get it back to you tomorrow if that meets the needs of the committee.
Claudia Black for the Oregon Medical Association. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I believe that the Oregon Medical Association would also be happy to work on those amendments.
Okay. That'd be great. We work on those and we also get this into line 13.
Chair Greenlick, yes, and line 15
line
as well.
15.
Yes.
Okay. That'd be great. We very much appreciate that.
Mr. Chair?
What was wrong?
I,
it's not unraveling anything.
If I can just say, I think it's just the first sentence of the 5A. I don't think you need to change B, but I haven't thought it through. I don't think you change B. You say, shall publish if, and then down in the B section, it's still, if you publish or if you disclose these situations. These. So it's just one sentence.
Yeah, the first one, right. Shall publish when.
Right. When it does,
when,
rather than shall not if it does not.
Okay, well. Let's do it. Thank you. Get it right this time. Thursday is the end. How about a motion to adopt the A4s? Might as well be doing something here. 337.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I move that we amend Senate Bill 337 with the dash A4 amendment.
Okay. I think we probably want to do fives as well, but let's do fours first. Is there any discussion on the A4s? That's what we're doing now.
Sentence that's being rewritten.
That's the one we're changing now. Is what's in the A4s.
So therefore, they should.
We don't need the A4s.
Put all ones.
Oh, we don't need any of them. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Well, the A5s we might.
Well, it's the A5. Mr. Chair, I withdraw my motion. Then, how about?
You have a good motion. Might as well use it for something.
Let's amend 337 with a dash A5.
Is there any discussion about that? That's the conflict amendment.
That's to do with the bill that's dealing with how we use persons with disabilities.
Here, right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Is there any objection to the A5s? So moved. The A5s are added to Senate Bill 337, and we'll await the A7s for Thursday and close the work session on HB 337 with our thanks. Let's see. It's after 320, right? Yeah, I would like to go back to 145. Can I open a work session on Senate Bill 145 and I just want to have a little discussion. Can I have Claudia and don't go out that door. In this area, can we talk about 145?
Mr. Chair, can I just say that after the last time we met, the OMA and the BME got together and had a meeting last Friday morning and said they had come up with some proposed amendments, and that's where I left off. They were going to get something drafted, so they seem to reach some kind of consensus on 145.
Is that the A7?
Mr. Chair, we do not have the amendments back. Council was working on them this morning, but there were a couple of glitches with some references in the proposed language, so I think it just slowed it down a bit. And we weren't able to have them for the meeting this afternoon, so we were waiting for those.
I'm hearing there's more conflict bubbling than even before. Is that right? Could you fill the committee in on what's going on and the question of the relationship between BME and the OMA on this whole program?
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, I'm Kathleen Haley, and I'm the executive director for the Board of Medical Examiners. The board met with the members of the Supervisory Council on May 7th, and they intend to continue meeting as a large body in the near future to continue to work on administrative structural issues.
That's the whole board meeting with the whole Supervisory Council?
Chair Greenlick, that's correct.
Are there any proposed change in leadership in the Supervisory Committee?
Chair Greenlich, the Board of Medical Examiners has a conference call scheduled to talk about that tomorrow afternoon.
I don't know what authority we have in this issue, but I'd really be nervous if the board was retaliating against a member of the profession for testimony before this committee. There's no possibility.
Chair Greenlich, I can assure you that that is not the modus operandi of the Board of Medical Examiners to retaliate against people.
Bonnie, do you have any comments on this whole thing? You don't have to comment.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Claudia Black with Oregon Medical Association, and my understanding is that the conference call tomorrow afternoon does involve the potential resignation or request for resignation for one of the members of the Health Professional Advisory Committee.
And you have a sense that this may be related to any testimony given before this committee?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I really hesitate to speculate on that.
Well, I don't know what to say, and I don't know what difference it makes if it happens in terms of any authority we have. But I'd really like to make sure you keep working at least for another 24 hours to make sure we get an amendment that you're both satisfied with. And I guess you should take it as a personal comment from me that it would affront the dignity of this committee. Somebody got fired from position because of testimony they gave before this committee. That would not be a very happy thing. You can pass that on to the board.
I'll do it.
Thank you very much. Close the work session on Senate Bill 145, and we'll finish that on Thursday. Okay, where are we? Well, let's have a public hearing and a possible work session on Senate Bill 614A. I mean, I'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 614A. And we got to talk to us about this. So why don't you tell us what this bill is about?
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 614, A. engrossed, comes to us from the Senate floor with 18 ayes and 10 noes, 2 excused. This bill requires members of a board of directors of a hospital authority to file a statement of economic interest and declare actual or potential conflict of interest based on a relationship with a nonprofit corporation. This has no revenue or fiscal impact at this time. And we have Lynn Marie Kreider here to speak to the bill.
And it's only relationship with nonprofit organizations?
That's my understanding, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Kreider, will you join us?
Chair Greenlich, members of the committee, my name is Lynn Marie Kreider, Service Employees International Union. Maybe I can explain what this little bill is about.
It's already in there.
Excuse me?
It's already in there for pecuniary interest. I'm sorry. Please go.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, SEIU does support this bill. As it comes to you, it simply makes a couple of changes, which Sandy has described. One requires that members of hospital facilities authorities that issue tax-exempt bonds for capital investment by nonprofit hospitals must file economic disclosure statements and must decline to participate in decision-making when a hospital whose board they sit on applies for a bond with the authority that they sit on. So we're asking the legislature basically to make sure that the process for deciding whether or not to issue what are rather massive bonds be protected from conflicts of interest. I can explain, I think it might be helpful for me to explain what this bond system looks like, and then I'll go to the technicalities of the bill, which are a bit confusing. You will note attached to my testimony are excerpts from Chapter 244, which are the general conflict of interest laws that are referenced or affected by this bill and aren't actually printed in the bill, so you may find those useful. Hospital companies pay some of the costs of construction and other capital improvements from reserves and cash flow. Some, the public district hospitals, may have a tax base, but many nonprofit hospitals secure low-interest loans in the form of tax-exempt revenue bonds that are issued by public entities. OHSU has the power to issue those revenue bonds. The Oregon Facilities Authority has the power to issue revenue bonds not only for hospitals but for a variety of other nonprofit organizations, including nonprofit higher education organizations. And then there are dozens in this state of municipally created hospital financing authorities, they're called. And they also have the power to issue tax-exempt revenue bonds. And it is those facility authorities that this bill addresses. The way the system works is that the public authority issues the bond, which is then repaid out of the revenue stream of the hospital. So the it isn't like a general obligation bond in the sense that the public is not on the hook to repay the bonds, but there is some effect on the public. There's some cost to the public because these bonds sell at below market rates of interest because the purchaser of the bond doesn't have to pay taxes on the interest that he or she earns on the bond. So they create a low-interest form of financing for hospitals. They can pay below market rates of interest because the holder of the bond doesn't have to pay taxes on what they earn. So that's the whole attractiveness of this system and why it works. What happens is that there are these municipally created hospital facilities authorities that have the power to issue the bonds, and they vary a great deal in nature. That is, the Multnomah County Hospital Facilities Authority is composed of the elected county commissioners. So those commissioners are filing economic disclosure statements because county commissioners have to file economic disclosure statements. But it is more typical for a facilities authority membership to be composed of people that are appointed by another public body, and are not well known and do not for other reasons have to file economic disclosure statements. Rather commonly, at least one of a member of a local facilities authority is an executive or a board member of the local hospital. They have an interest in what's going on there. And very often those facilities authorities are housed they don't have staff. They are housed in the local hospital, or their records are housed in the bond council's office, or they're simply very small entities that don't do a lot of business. They may see one or two applications a year, and it may be from that one local hospital in that community. So right now, turning to the bill, members of the Oregon Facilities Authority, that multi-purpose bonding authority that exists at the state level, they file economic disclosure statements. That is already the case. And what Section 2 of the bill does is to add members of these local hospital finance authorities to that long list of public officials that have to file economic disclosure statements. The second thing that the bill does is address the conflict.
All right, Section 2 of the bill, meaning...
Section 2 of the bill at page 4, line 7, you'll see...
All right, you're talking about the second part of the amendments, not...
Yes, I'm sorry, that was the simpler one, and so, but it is the second piece of the amendment.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
That's all right. So that's the economic disclosure piece. Then in Section 1... there is an additional change. And so let me give you the background on it. And it deals with the conflict of interest rules as applied to these authorities. ORS Chapter 244 establishes the general rules about conflict of interest by public officials, including the members of this body, as well as all kinds of other entities. You don't see 244 in the bill since it's 14A, and that's why I have the attachments, which are the relevant portions of 244 for you. Basically, 244.020 sub 1 defines an actual conflict of interest to include any action or decision or recommendation by a person acting in the capacity of a public official if it would affect the private pecuniary benefit or detriment of the person or the person's relative or any business with which the person or relative of the person is associated, unless the pecuniary benefit or detriment arises out of circumstances described in subsection 14. And subsection 14 says that there is no conflict of interest if the pecuniary benefit or detriment arises out of membership on the board of directors of a nonprofit corporation that's tax exempt under 501c3. So basically, what you have is a situation where the general rules about conflict of interest would normally say that if a member of a board of directors, for example, of a for-profit hospital or any other kind of business came before a public agency and wanted something of benefit to that organization, a conflict of interest would exist, and the effect of that would be, according to 244, that the member needs to disclose that conflict, and the member should not must not participate in discussion or voting on that matter unless his vote is actually necessary to getting a decision. That is, essentially, if there's a quorum type problem, then the public official could vote but not participate in the discussion. But because of the exception in subsection 14 of 020, if the pecuniary benefit or detriment is to a nonprofit organizing under 501c3 of the IRS code, then you can, as a public official, pass on something that has that pecuniary effect on your own organization. So the effect is that the member of a hospital board of directors can sit on a hospital facilities authority and can vote on its own hospital's application for a multimillion-dollar tax-exempt revenue bond. Now, it's my understanding that generally, but I do not know how often, that generally those kinds of conflicts are disclosed, and generally, or often at any rate, the member of the Facilities Authority does not now vote. And in the House, we had testimony from bond counsel who said that he advises that that be done. But the fact of the matter is the law would permit that kind of conflict of interest to take place, and this simply plugs that gap.
Kreider, I'm trying to understand the need for this. Is the concern that there will be directors on a nonprofit's board that would seek after and prove and obtain bonding that is tax privileged and then invest in it themselves, and therefore there's this inherent conflict? Or I'm trying to figure out what is the problem we're trying to solve with this disclosure?
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, I think the problem is not the one you've identified, but rather is that I'm on the board of the hospital. We've decided that we need to borrow $50 million and that we're going to go down the hall and apply to the Hospital Facilities Authority for that bond. And there is a responsibility to make a wise decision about whether or not the bond should issue, and the same fellow who sat on the hospital board is also on the other board, and therefore is in a situation where he's making a decision that is he's not neutral on.
That may be especially true if two institutions are competing for finite amount of bonding authority.
Representative Mom?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm trying to figure out where the economic interest is. I mean, I can understand a pride interest. I mean, because these are volunteer positions. I don't know of a hospital authority that's paid on a 501c3 governing body. I guess I don't see where the economic interest is.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Maurer, actually some members of 501c3 hospital boards are paid, but I think it is simply that the hospitals are a very big business, and to say that it's not a personal pecuniary interest, but that might be so of a business too, and nonetheless, if you're a business that you're associated has a stake in something, you would be.
As a member of a board,
yes,
of a foundation board for a hospital, I have to fill out a conflict of interest form, not for the state, but for their, I believe it's the federal requirement, that I have to disclose any economic interest I have with that organization. And so I guess I'm trying to look for the economic interest. I mean, if you have an economic interest, I think, yes, there's a conflict. But just because you're a member of a board doesn't necessarily mean you're going to have an economic interest.
No, but it doesn't mean you don't have an interest.
Or I guess then my question is, are not all 501c3 executive board members required to fill out a conflict of interest form?
No. I'm a foundation board member. I've never filled one out for the foundation. But this isn't about that anyway. This isn't about the hospital board or the foundation board. It's about this other public body that's issuing bonds.
Still looking for the economic conflict. So,
Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Trying to kind of narrow the focus and clarify my understanding here. This is giving a new definition to a public official as a director of a hospital board. Is that?
No. It's the public official is a director of the hospital bonding authority. Right?
Well, I'm looking at sub 4 on page 117. Notwithstanding the exception for pecuniary benefit or detriment described in ORS 244.02014C, a director is a public official subject to the requirements of ORS Chapter 244 based on the actual conflict of interest or a potential conflict of interest arising out of the director's relationship. So we're rolling a director of a hospital board into a public official status.
No, I don't believe that's correct.
Mr. Chair, Representative Flores, I don't think that's what it means. What it's saying is that even though there's this exception for members of nonprofit boards can act in a situation which otherwise would create a conflict of interest under the statute, it basically says in the case of hospital facilities authorities, that exception for nonprofit board of directors does not exist. I'm not sure whether that's
for directors of the public funding authority, not for directors of the hospital board.
Okay, I'll wait for the excuse me, the definition that I see Representative Richardson's looking up, but may I have a follow-up question?
Yes, go for it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, as you want.
Or two, then. Okay.
Go for it.
Ms. Kreider, and what I heard you say, there is currently disclosure being made by members of boards that voting members are advised by the bonding group to so disclose. So disclosures are being made, but we need this in statute to make sure that it's being done, although it is currently being done.
Mr. Chair, Representative Flores, we know that sometimes it's being done. I don't know whether it's always being done, and I think there's nothing to assure us that there isn't rather participation in the discussion of those matters by a person with a conflict of interest, which would not happen.
You have a blank check.
Bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, then, to the contrary, do you have indications of problems having arisen because there have not been these disclosures? Do you have a pattern of some irregularities as a result of disclosures not being made?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, in terms of the economic disclosure, we simply don't know who the people are that are making decisions. So that's the economic interest statement piece. In terms of participation in the activity, this is something that we began to look at in our union because of our concern about the extent of hospital construction that was going on. We have not done a thorough examination of all of the records of hospital facilities authorities to know what's being done. There was an article published last week in Oregon Health News that described a couple of authorities where they found, and I can share that with you if you would like, that there were hospital boards of directors on the local facilities authority, and there wasn't an answer in there in the article. It did not indicate that it indicated that the individual had participated. It's not something I'm familiar with.
Mr. Chair, can I rephrase my question?
No.
Write a note. I've got a carte blanche here.
Okay. here's an example. If I was on a hospital governing board, and I'm also on the hospital authority, but I have no connection to healthcare other than I happen to be on these two boards. Is the mere fact that I'm volunteering for both these boards a conflict of interest? Now, if my livelihood is tied to the hospital that I'm on a board with, it's clearly a conflict. I guess it'd be construed as conflict. But you know, the organizations that I'm familiar with are not this way. These are volunteer people. So is that a conflict because you just happen to volunteer for the wrong people, the wrong organization?
Mr. Chair, Representative Maurer, I think it is. You've made a decision in one context that you want to get a bond issue. And then with your other hat, you get to decide that question. Doesn't mean you're bad. Doesn't mean that it's wrong that you want to do what you want to do. It just means that you aren't a neutral in the matter.
Then in my...
You're in a city like Portland where you have competing hospital associations, competing hospital authorities. There's a lot of competition among those institutions. And it's not, and the boards get involved in that. They get psychically involved in it. And this is a question of the, well, I mean, you spend, 18 meetings a year going to a hospital board meeting and you get committed to that institution. And the question is there an appearance of conflict in the circumstances so that when St. Vincent's is applying for a bond and there's a limited amount of things and you have a St. Vincent's director on the bonding authority bond, I mean, all he's saying is declare that and step aside. And it isn't, I think, for financial interest, although many a hospital board directors are paid, sometimes very well, even in the nonprofit arena. That's not the issue. It's really this, this apparent conflict that those of us that are on these boards get kind of committed to them. Can I ask a technical question? This is, I need to disclose anything under 501C, not C3. Right? That's what you've written here. You said C3.
You are correct.
So a church, if I'm a deacon in the church, I would have to disclose this under this. Is that right?
Well, the deacon in the church probably is not applying for a hospital revenue bond.
So it's the question of the actual conflict or potential conflict of interest that arises.
You have to have that association, and then this takes away the exemption.
Is there any opposition to this?
Mr. Chair, no one in this form, no one said before the committee we are opposed to this bill.
That's a carefully answered.
Well, I don't know why there were 10 votes against it in the Senate. I don't lobby here, so maybe you want to ask someone else.
No, but I mean, there wasn't any formal opposition before the committee testimony.
That's correct.
Is anybody in the room that's... anybody sign up in opposition?
Mr. Chair, as Mr. Bishop is walking forward, is that the only conflict that you're declaring? Am I going to have to declare that I have $100,000 of publicly held stock in any company, or is that the only conflict that I'm going to declare?
Mr. Chair, Representative Maurer, I'm not sure I understand. I mean, you will have to file, if you are a member of one of these hospital finance authorities, you would have to file the same kind of economic disclosure statement that you file as a legislator.
Standard. It's a standard.
Yeah.
Peace Health did provide written testimony in opposition in the Senate.
What about lunches with lobbyists?
$10.
Hello.
In the Senate, no limit.
Mr. Bishop, do you have any comment on that?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Bruce Bishop, appearing on behalf of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. We had strenuous opposition to Senate Bill 614 as originally proposed. Most of those objectionable provisions were stripped out of the bill. So there was very strong opposition to the bill as it was considered in the Senate. The portions of the bill that remain are not such that we opposed the bill in the Senate.
And that's the bill we're looking at here.
That's the bill that's before you. We think, we're not sure there's a need for the bill in that form, but we're not opposing it. and I think as Ms. Kreider has testified, in many instances, members of authority boards are disclosing that they are affiliated or have a relationship with a hospital, whether it's as a board member or as an executive or in some other capacity. The law does not, the conflict of interest law does not require that disclosure. This bill would say that in that event, you're required to make that kind of disclosure. I believe that in most communities, it's probably widely known, but just as you're required as public officials to make disclosures, this would apply the same requirements to members of those facility authority boards to make disclosures when a hospital with which they have a relationship has a project in front of them as a facility authority.
And this does create, in the page 4 amendment, this does make members of these authority boards public officials. Is that right? I went all the way back from S, right? Small s, which takes it back to well, before April 15th of each year, the following persons shall file with the Oregon Government Standards and Practices Commission a verified statement of economic interest as required under this chapter. And this subsection S adds members of the board of the authorities to file that disclosure. That's what that person said.
Mr. Chair, yes, it requires that it adds them to the list of public officials. I don't think it makes them a public official. They're already public officials, but it adds them to the list of those that must file the disclosure statement.
And that's the standard one that we all fill out, right?
That's correct.
Okay. Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I would just suggest that might be an element of why you had 10 no votes in the Senate. And is that is an element of why.
Somebody's filled out that form?
Not only that, but it is a broadening the category of public official or redefining it or adding it to a definition, I think, which was my first question.
These are for the authority directors, though, not for the hospital boards. Correct.
And Mr. Chair, just to sort of close that loop, those officials on authority boards are already public officials.
They are public officials.
The question is whether they should be required to file statements of economic interest.
They're only dealing with millions and millions of dollars. Why would that be?
The answer would be because they're serving in a nonprofit capacity in which they, from which they derive no personal pecuniary benefit.
Unless they do.
And if they do, then they would disclose it.
Yeah. Okay.
But, Mr. Chair, they wouldn't be required to unless we had this. Is that correct? I mean, I don't think we know. I don't think we know. There's millions and millions of dollars going through these hospital authorities. We just don't know. And I think this is just a transparency issue, and it makes sense.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kotek, I think there are millions and millions of dollars going through the nonprofit sector. You don't know about those either. You're segmenting one portion of the nonprofit sector for that disclosure, but there are lots of other nonprofit programs for which there is not similar disclosure.
But these aren't nonprofit agencies. These are government agencies, aren't they? The bonding authority?
The relationship that you're requiring disclosure about is because of the relationship with a nonprofit organization, which is the hospital. There are lots of other nonprofit organizations that are not similarly required to disclose, you know, funds flowing through them.
Well,
I have a question.
Yep.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for clarification, is it a disclosure only or a disclosure and recusal?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, it's both.
So it's a disclosure and recusal?
That's correct.
Well,
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, I think in the event of a potential conflict, it would be disclosure. In the event of an actual conflict, then it could require recusal.
Under the existing statute, under
244.
Under 244.020.
Mr. Chair, under the existing statute, where you have an actual conflict of interest, you have to recuse yourself unless the vote is necessary in order to have the number of votes that are required. I mean, there's a description of what, and you have it in front of you, and on page 3 of my appendix there. But I'm sorry, I've sort of lost myself here. But the rules in the existing statute say if there's an actual conflict of interest, then you may not participate except in certain narrow exceptions. The problem is the existing statute defines away that conflict of interest if it's created by association with a 501c3 organization. And that's what we're doing, is eliminating that. Then the director of a hospital financing authority, who is also director of a nonprofit hospital, falls within the actual conflict of interest rules of the existing statute.
Mr. Chair, I would disagree with that characterization of what the effect of the bill would be. It would, I believe, require disclosure of conflicts of interest, which could be either perceived or actual, but it does not declare that a relationship with a hospital necessarily creates an actual conflict of interest.
Hmm. Even in voting on things relating to that specific hospital?
To have an actual conflict of interest, I think, requires a higher level of relationship, including a pecuniary benefit from the relationship that may or may not exist, depending on the role that the person has. So, to Representative Maurer's point, there may be board members who are participating in both who don't have a personal pecuniary interest or benefit. There may be some who do. Those who do could rise to the level of a real conflict, but not everyone does by this bill.
Hmm. Okay. We're in work session. Oh, we're in a public hearing. Oh, I can take care of that. In the public hearing. Senate Bill 614, and open a work session on Senate Bill 614. Do I hear a motion?
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 614A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Discussion.
Mr. Chair, just morbid curiosity why this was assigned to our committee and not ethics and rules, for example. And I realize the hospital and healthcare, but it's not really a hospital or healthcare function we're looking at. We're looking at a sort of a government ethics function. I'm wondering if this referral with no...
sometimes that's mythical process.
A mythical process?
Which shows up. I'm extremely surprised to find bills somewhere else that I thought should be here. And sometimes equally surprised to find bills here that might have been somewhere else. But I don't remember having anything to do with that selection on this one. I don't know. Who knows? Maybe I did.
I have a question. How widely... How many boards are there that are financing of healthcare facilities construction? Is this
29.
Each of them has
the ability to
five or more directors, could be 10 directors. So we're dealing with a potential population that will be subjected somewhere between 50 and 100 people in the state of Oregon.
That same dumb form, yeah. I think it's good for the soul. That's what it's...
I'm wondering, since all of us up here have to fill out that that statement of economic interest, if this doesn't, if we don't know and have to recuse ourselves, we know this falls under cruel and unusual punishment.
Right, we may have a conflict of interest, we may not be able to vote on it. Of course, our rules in this building is you vote even when you have a conflict. Especially when you have a conflict of interest, you vote. We have a sort of different look at this one.
We're in work session, right?
We're in work session.
I just want to comment. I think some of this should just be taken care of by the fiduciary duty that a board member owes to his or her organization. I'll support the bill, and I think it's important for them to declare a conflict, but I'm a little baffled by it.
Well, if I might, Mr. Chair, I think we heard that disclosures are occurring. Members are being advised to disclose, and we do not know the extent of the problem, if there even is one.
Mr. Chair, a comment, and I could be wrong about this, but as I read 244, a business is defined as anything except anything you'd imagine as a business, except a non-for-profit 501c, and then the reason that's defined is that an actual conflict of interest only arises when you have a private pecuniary benefit or a business with which you're associated has a private pecuniary benefit. So I'm not sure that we'll get these actual conflict of interests required by statute anyway, even by passing this bill. I think there might be some additional work that needs to be done to sort of hone in on the hospital, the not-for-profit hospitals. I'm just reading the first two definitions in the appendix testimony, the appendix to the testimony. I think this bill is a step in the right direction. I particularly think the economic disclosure forms for members of these public boards are entirely consistent with disclosures that we require of members of other public bodies, including the legislature.
Any other discussion? Aaron, will you call the roll, please?
Aye.
No.
Aye.
No.
Aye.
Mauer. Aye. 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 The motion passes. We need a carrier, and preferably one who said yes.
Oh, let me!
Oh, you've got one today. Why don't we let Representative Bonamici?
I will do that. Thank
you. Do this one. We may need a lawyer to explain what we just did. All right. Close the work session on Senate Bill 614A and open a work session on Open a work session on 717. And why are you supposed to gavel these things? Does anybody know the origin of that?
Make us up,
I was curious about that. Probably came from the Knights of the Round Table.
Exactly.
I suggest that it's a work session so we can talk. Let me tell you where I am. I had a conversation today with Senator Modest Anderson on this. It seemed to me we had pretty strong testimony that there are a lot of people that think the idea may be a good idea, but a problem housing the Board of Medical Examiners. I proposed an amendment that would put this under the Oregon Health Policy Commission, and I've heard if we do that, it might engender a $1.4 million fiscal. Dr. Smith, you want to talk to us about that?
Do we have the dash for a
moment? It's in the package you have. Or it may be in the package you have.
No? Oh, sorry.
It,
you have them?
It basically inserts Oregon Health Policy Commission wherever it says Oregon Board of Medical Examiners. Basically the function of it. Well, I'm not sure you do have to go get copies right now, so let's
and Representative Greenlick and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dr. Jeanine Smith, the Administrator for the Office of Health Policy and Research, which oversees the Health Policy Commission, the Health Resources Commission.
I don't oversee it. It staffs.
And staffs it, too. That's correct. We don't oversee it. You oversee the Health Policy Commission oversees me. I was not part of the original work group that Senator Mona Anderson had when this was over on the Senate side. They had wanted to put this bill into OHPR at that time, and I had presented some testimony feeling that this was really outside of our scope of practice. And I
have provided basically my comments. I had looked around a little bit to see what other states were doing. Maine does include evidence into their reports, but they do it through a regulatory entity and agency. But with the wishes of wanting to put it in the Health Policy Commission, I think it's probably better suited for the Health Resources Commission, which works very closely already with the OHSU Evidence-Based Policy Center on the drug reviews and clinical technology reviews. So the Policy Commission could work with the Health Resources Commission since they oversee them technically as well. But I did a fiscal just trying to think about how to do this and not knowing exactly what else we may get on our plate through other bills such as 329. But the staff of probably the Health Resources Commission I currently have, which is a physician, and his network of the working with the evidence-based center. I added one additional staff, and then I looked to see, trying to guess how many of these there would be. And I don't know. I guessed about 10 a year of scope of practice, which would be 20 in a biennium. Looking at you wanting an evidence-based review, I discussed with Mark Gibson, who heads the evidence-based center, that they would need to be reimbursed for their efforts to collect that data as they are now, but they don't do this, not the way we do it with 40 other states for the drug reviews, which brings the cost down. So that in a course of looking at what an individual evidence-based review cost, it was about $35,000. So a lot of the fiscal is based on purchasing that evidence-based review and manning anywhere from 10 to 20, 30, who knows. I'm not sure how many of these scope of practice work groups you will end up having as staff. So that was my best estimate I could give legislative fiscal.
And the Board of Medical Examiners says that they can do this with their existing staff?
Yeah, and to my understanding, yes. I'm not sure if they appreciated what the cost would be for the evidence-based center.
And, Mr. Chair, as clarification, there was an original assumption, and did Janine cover this? When fiscal did their evaluation of this on the Senate side, there was an original assumption that the evidence-based policy kind of generated these reports, and then they were shelved, and that we would just have to tap into them. They just now discovered that it's generated by request. So nobody's rule, and I haven't had a thorough discussion, if it was an oversight on the Senate side, this very possibly could have had this fiscal, even through the BME, on the other side, but it just was never raised.
Does the bill really assert that
every process has to include its own independent review, Jenny?
Well, that was my understanding, because that our role, be it UPR or HPC, HRC, was just to convene these groups, but that we would work with the evidence-based center. They would provide, I think it's on the second page, the evidence-based information provided by the Center for Evidence-Based Policy, line 6 of the amended engrossed. And that was my understanding from talking to Senator Mona Anderson when we were possibly going to be in the bill in the first place.
Your understanding was that there would be a separate evidence-based review?
Mm-hmm. That there would be evidence provided to this work group so that you as legislators would get a report that has the pro views, the con views, and what's the evidence say. And if you look, I looked, and Maine has a report similar to that where they did pull the literature to see what, the evidence of a denturist having increased responsibilities versus a dentist, and they put that in this very nice report that's about 40 pages of the pros and cons, and I assume that's kind of what you're looking for. And I shared that document with Mona Anderson. I didn't get a chance to make copies today. But you'd have to have somebody review the literature or make some guesstimate of evidence, and I didn't think we didn't have the people power to do that inside our office, and we wanted that sort of, and if you had 40 states all purchasing this together, it would maybe be a lot cheaper. It's sort of an intriguing idea and a new collaborative effort that maybe the center could undertake, but At this point, they don't have anything on the shelf.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
So the Center for Evidence-Based Policy, what do they do?
Representative Maurer and Representative Greenlee, currently there's about 40 states that we all put money in collectively to have the evidence gathered for us through some center, through some research entities, and then they help share that information, and we all get a combined report, and the states all work together around drugs for the drug reviews.
Yeah, actually, that's only one piece of it,
yeah.
Right?
And then
I may have a conflict of interest since I think I'm the deputy director of that thing still. I don't ever remember being fired, but I don't ever remember being called to a meeting in the last 3 years either. But basically, they on contract, a large contract from the Agency for Healthcare Financing and Research or whatever it is. What's it called now?
AHRQ.
AHRQ.
This isn't Mark Healthland's group. This is Mark Gibson's group.
That's a whole different ballgame. Lots more there. You see, I have a conflict of interest. I have these attitudes. I don't even get paid. So.
No comment.
No comment.
So this isn't the center. This is. It's confusing because OHSU has the Center for Evidence-Based Policy, and then it has Mark Helfand's research group, which does a particular
research.
Also
does drug reviews.
Yeah.
Too.
Well, they'll do a specific, you know, drug class review, but they don't do a. So.
Maybe we should find out from Mark if they're willing to do all this free. That would be nice.
I'm still not quite sure. If it doesn't exist, I don't see that they're necessarily obligated to expend resources to get that answer.
Well, it's one of the five things.
It's the evidence-based information provided by OHSU. And so we don't have it. I mean, that could very well be an answer.
Well, Representative Maurer and the committee, I would. I don't think someone has to, maybe there is literature, maybe someone has changed the scope of practice somewhere, has there been any studies done, it's constantly evolving, you know, 5 years from now there might be, from looking at what they had done in Maine, they had, reported four or five studies where there had been, someone had actually looked at it, it might have been small little pilots, and certain projects.
Well, I worked out a compromise with Senator Montes Anderson that we'd send this to Rules Committee so it could stay alive if we can't deal with it. I have a sense we're having a little trouble dealing with it. Should we continue to try and deal with it? Or?
Mr. Chair?
Yep.
I think this is a really important bill, and I think it will be an imperfect bill, even if it goes to Rules. I think the question both of how much information, given limited dollars, this committee is able to provide, where this committee is housed, I don't think that should keep us from passing this bill, because the worst that could happen is that we come back in 2009 with this, keep calling it a committee, this committee having provided sort of insufficient or unsatisfying information with respect to scope of practice issues, and then the advocates will come up and argue with each other, and we'll go through this whole process again. But that's the worst condition, and possibly, we will get some information from it, and even if it is housed in a organization that not everybody's happy with, and even if it has insufficient access to information. So while I would, applaud any efforts to improve the bill, I also think it shouldn't get hung up.
Well, I think we had a ton of testimony against having it in the Board of Medical Examiners. And I tend to agree with the testimony, and not that I think the Board of Medical Examiners is necessarily biased, but the appearance of bias on the face of it. And the strongest evidence I had, if Ms. Black is back there, when she said, oh, it's no problem, BME's fine, they're objective, it's no problem. I said, how about if we put it in the Board of Nursing Examiners? And she said, OMA would be opposed to it instantly. I mean, it really does point out that this is a, I mean, it does matter where it is. And if we're going to find a neutral place for it, and they're going to come up with a $1.5 million fiscal, then that kills the bill. And if we put it in the Board of Nursing, whatever it's called, the OMA will jump off it. If we put it in the Board of Naturopathic Examiners, everybody will jump off, I suppose. We could put it with a massage therapist. They seem not to have enough to do. Well, they don't have any pathology anymore. We could
create one.
Yeah, Red Health will be busy for the next while. I mean, I don't know what to do with it. Yes.
Well, Mr. Chair, I was just wondering, on a technical detail, could we, what if we deleted E on page 2?
Oh, yeah, that's a good question.
The only reason I say that is, I know that was added in on the Senate side, but it doesn't really follow. We're trying to provide us some criteria of how we look at these scope of practice issues. I think you could get to some of the answers in A through D by looking at the information provided from OHSU, but by requiring it, I don't know if somebody could explain why that was added in over on the set specific. It's not.
Yeah, and why?
It's nice.
Why this,
you know,
group, not the one that really does this kind of thing? I mean, the Evidence Practice Center actually looks at these kind of questions.
Because I think this would be, given the scope of practice bills that we've seen in the session, I think they'd have to work really hard to come up with evidence-based information. I think one of the challenges of the scope of practice is that we're forging new ground. And it's very difficult to go and point. If we wait for the evidence to arise, we might not make any, decisions at all. So that one in particular just struck me as...
I think, Representative Kotick, it was to help balance the BME handling this. It was trying to bring some neutrality. I wasn't part of the original work group, but my understanding was when it was the BME as the convener and the Center for Evidence Policy would provide that neutral sort of voice. And that's why those two were put together in the original bill.
What would it be for fiscal to take that out?
I'd still need a staff to do this in the sense that...
You already gave it the office on the...
I've been giving the office a bit, yes. Especially if we did get 329, most of my staff will be a little busy with broad health care reform, of which this is a key aspect. But I just don't know the volume and magnitude of this. And we have the Health Resources Commission is constantly having work groups on drug classes and medical technology assessments, and so this would be another thing they would have to absorb. Again, Health Resources, I don't think the Health Policy Commission could really... it's beyond what they would be focused on.
Well, ideally, it would be nice to have it in one spot for consistency and continuity and things like that. To get at one of the issues around the BME, I'm going to throw something out. What if we just rotated? So if it was the month of January, you want to talk about scope, it went to this board and that board, and as long as it didn't conflict with, if it was a nursing issue, you didn't send it to the nurses and or, I don't know. I mean, you got a lot of boards. They all have staff. We just need someone to convene something. I don't think it's necessarily bringing expertise. I'm just throwing it out there.
Well, let me ask the committee to do this. I mean, I agree with you. It would be so much easier for us if somebody else had done the psychologist, psychiatrist, and the ophthalmologist, optometrist, and the massage therapist, and the reflexologist. But, I mean, theoretically, those would have been things that would have come to us with an answer rather than with a dilemma that made it almost a purely political decision. I mean, if anybody here can think of something to do with it between now and Thursday, let's try and get it done. And let's try and get an amendment that would do that. If not, Thursday we have two options. We have an amendment, we have the original bill, and we have the ability to send it to rules to keep it alive. Maybe we just take a straw vote to see which is... You would not like that amendment to be the Health Policy Commission. You think that amendment should say the Health Resources Commission?
I think that would be a better fit if you really want someone who's used to kind of trying to look at the literature and giving you those kind of reactions.
We need that change in it, so we'll have that in front of us.
There is an amendment that has just given it to UPER that was written already on the Senate side.
And you can put it where you want.
But it might be simpler.
Oh, and let's get that amendment to delete the evidence-based thing as well. Let's see. Maybe you could give us some rough idea of what that might do to the fiscal.
Now or no? It's, no, I can get back to
no,
yes.
Thursday. Yeah. But also, I mean, we can also limit the number of these that were done at any time.
I guess the issue is I don't know how many meetings would this be? How many times would it take a work group to meet? You know, four or five times, a couple of times to argue about what that report's going to be.
If it's psychologists and psychiatrists, it would be till the fourth of never.
If you look at the number of scope of practice bills that, in my experience, the last four sessions, is a huge number, and I know you need some help with them, but I'm not sure how many work groups to count on.
Mr. Chair, if I could just throw out, is trying to think about different things here. What about limiting the number and then making this something that Legislative Committee Services deals with, and that leadership, Speaker and the Senate President decide? I mean, I don't think every scope of practice issue should get some time. I mean, to be very honest.
But want to get it out of this building. I mean, that's Montes Anderson and Courtney's objective, is to get some place out of this building where it can be theoretically discussed on a not the same political, so that we got some feedback that would make it easier on us. That's their objective, I think.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I like this bill, and I think it's important, and if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. I mean, there's nothing that says people can't usurp the system and go around and do exactly what they've been doing already. And I would like to see us give it a chance. And I think we can come up with something by Thursday. Quite critical.
Representative,
I would concur with Representative Maurer. I've found it from my position on this committee. I know there's people on this committee that have professional backgrounds in healthcare. I'm not one of those people. And so when we've had these scope of practice dogfights, it puts us in an uncomfortable and unscientific position more often than not. So, yeah, I agree with Representative Maurer. I think, Representative Cannon made a great point. Hey, it may not be perfect, but I think this idea is an idea whose time has come.
I can tell you it's no less uncomfortable even if you have some background to feel. I mean, they're viewed. I don't think they are, but they're viewed as win-lose situations. They win, we've lost. I mean, and once they get framed that way, and they seem to get framed that way very early in the discussion, it's very uncomfortable. I mean, if we could save ourselves some pain, it would be a good thing. Small work group, maybe?
Mr. Chair, I would volunteer to participate in any effort.
Okay. How about Ben and Tina?
I can.
You guys down?
I'm
in the right wing of this?
That's
right. Always together.
Let's see if we can get something by Thursday.
What's the dash amendments that we have that have over?
I don't know if the dash twos or threes.
Oh, but they're not A's. Yes,
council will have
not,
them, and we'll get a redraft.
It's not that.
And the advantage of that is it gives it generically rather than to
rather than
policy or health resources. It hands it.
Mr. Chair, do you want that amendment incorporated with deleting the evidence-based language on page 2, line 6
well,
and 7?
Well, you can check with the...
Or just wait till the committee members get back to us on what they want to do?
There's no hurry.
Okay.
We have until...
Okay.
Until midday tomorrow to get something drafted, probably. Okay. Let's close the work session on 717. Can we find out? Let's open a work session on 656 and see where we are at the moment. Anybody want to talk to us?
Well,
you want to talk to us?
The most I can do, Mr. Chair, is Senate Bill 656, you'll recall, is the optometrist, allows the optometrist to treat a patient with anti-glaucoma medication and to consult with an ophthalmologist with specified conditions. We have many amendments.
That's nice.
Of which the only one that, and please remember that the committee adopted the A4s on the 21st of May, so those are already been adopted. The amendments that I worked on were the A8s, which just add some clarifying languages to the requirements for the optometrist to consult with an ophthalmologist, which you do have a hand and gross version of not only the A4s, but just a few word changes on the A8s. I believe you have at your packet the A9s, the A10s, and the A11s, of which I believe one of our committee members can really speak to those.
And who might that be?
That would be
Representative Gelson.
Talk to us.
Right now?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. I put these in after receiving a communication from the optometrists, and I think I'd let you know before I put them in and brought them here for discussion. And it's basically all one suggestion broken up into three. The A9s simply switch from a single medication to two medications, being the threshold. The second talks on its own about what a progression would be, and the A11 puts both of those pieces together.
A10 talks about progression.
Right. So the A9 and the A10 are the A11 broken in half, so that if the committee was comfortable with moving to the two medications, they could do that. If they were comfortable with changing the language around getting worse, then they could go with the A10s. If they like both, they could go with the A11s.
I'm sorry. So what's in the 11? The 11 is a combination of 8 and 10?
No, of A9 and A10. And basically what it says, it does two things. It says that rather than that threshold being managed with a single medication, it's if it's more than two medications, and that it also puts some definition around what a worsening condition is so that it's in comparison to a prior examination.
Have you all seen those things? Your comments on them?
And I was told in the hallway, I have not had the opportunity to check with the other parties, but a bird has whispered in my ear that there's potential comfort with the A11s from other parties, but I don't.
What species of bird was that?
A little bird.
A little bird.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you. Just a clarification. Now, we have a hand engrossed that has included the A4s and the A8s, and I didn't have my A8s as marked having been adopted, but I mean.
No.
The A8s have not been adopted, just the A4s.
Okay, thank you.
The A8s is one word or two words, right?
No, that's nine.
No, the A8s also.
Okay. The A8s are like three words. Mm-hmm. Insert, reproducible, target, and
glaucomatous.
Thank you, glaucomatous. Wrong accent.
It's easy for you, sir.
No, it's easy for you to say.
Reproducible worsening.
Exactly.
My understanding of it is that things can be variable, so you need to look at it and then look at it again to see if it's the same. Can happen. I think that is what we mean by that.
Exactly. We're not getting a double blind or anything like that.
No.
Single blind is bad enough about problems.
No, that's what I was worried about.
Mr. Chair, if I may. Members of the committee, Mr. Chair, I'm Nan Heim, representing the Oregon Academy of Ophthalmology. The A8 amendments, which add those three words, reproducible, target, and glaucomatous, were the result of discussions between a member of our legislative committee and of the optometrist legislative committee. And reproducible, as it was explained to me, this is exactly how it was explained to me, if you eat Fritos for lunch, your reading could come out, it could affect your reading. So they want it to be, it's a term that they're very familiar with and that they both agreed to, that it needs to be reproducible. And that means that it wasn't, if it's reproducible, then it wasn't a strange reading.
Wasn't my eye surgery, I was in a single visit and had my intraocular pressure measured twice within 20 minutes, and it was 27 at one point and 22 at the next point. With two different readings, with two different professionals, both of whom do a lot of readings. And it was very interesting to me, and then, you know, when I did have post-surgical intraocular pressure problem, which post-surgical gone away. I think I interrupted you.
No,
Chairman.
The goal of the word...
Please introduce yourself. It was Nan Hine before, is that right? Is that who you were?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Bob Tybalt. I'm an ophthalmologist representing the Oregon Academy of Ophthalmologists of Ophthalmology. The word reproducible was introduced because any test has inherent error that it is capable of, and to document a real change in visual fields, for example, rather than just believe the change with one test, for it to become statistically significant, you have to repeat the test, and then that proves that it's real rather than artifact or error.
Error, you can mean natural variation in that sense.
That could be included.
The error term, yeah. Wayne, you have...
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Wayne Schumacher, Executive Director of the Oregon Optometric Physicians Association. And to kind of sum it up, and I think where we are is we both agree that the Dash 8 amendments make language changes which help and make it more clear. We're certainly amenable to that. We're also amenable to the adoption of the A11s, which essentially adds the word abnormal in front of glaucomatose. There's some question that may be a duplication of terms and redundant, but it seems to have a comfort level with our folks. And that's in line 20, but more so up on the top there in A11, it's the issue if the prescription is more than two medications, that would be a threshold as opposed to one medication. And the reason for that is we're aware of a rather landmark study that was published in 2002 in the Archives of Ophthalmology, in the Ocular Hypertension Treatment Study, and it basically showed that 40% of patients with glaucoma are being treated with more than one medication. That means, as Representative Maurer had pointed out in his question and testimony at the hearing, we're talking about thousands of folks who have glaucoma and are being treated for it. 40% of those would end up in under this concept right now. So that means a lot of patients are going to hit that threshold, probably unnecessarily. So in discussions just before this work session or the convening of this committee meeting, we discussed A11, and it seems to be substantially acceptable to both parties. So we would be comfortable with the bill if we had the A8s and the A11s adopted.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this bill started off in the Senate and was passed by the Senate with the language of one medicine, so that's our position. The progression of going from one drop to two drops is a natural one and occurs with some frequency, but the armamentarium of treating eye pressure includes laser. And laser treatment is something that is appropriate for many patients at the point where you go from one to two. Some people don't have money for medicines. Some people don't want to take any more medicines. Laser is a way that one can lower eye pressure without medicine. So it's a logical point to consider another option. And I really want to remind everybody that this bill proposes to request a consultation. It's not a transfer of care. It's merely to make a call to an ophthalmologist. And that's the intent. And so whether it's one or two, you know, that's what we want, the phone call to be made. So, you know, that's an issue. But the logic behind sticking with one is that laser is a valuable option that for many people might be the right one. And so it's a good time to call and say, hey, where do we go from here? Is laser an option? That's I think the bottom line was one or two.
Doctor, is it correct that if laser wasn't an option, that the progression is you'd go to two medications?
Mr. Chairman, Vice Chairman Richardson, yes.
So as soon as you're at two medications, then there's going to be a consult, and then laser could be mentioned.
I think that would be after the second one. Is that the intention of 11 Representative
I believe that the intent is that that consultation would not be required until after you needed more than two medications, yeah, if I read this correctly.
That's what the intention is. Right now, it's when you were about to prescribe the second one, not counting combinations, that would be the time for the consult. Or any of these other things happening.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I think there's a plausible reading of this, of the -11 amendment, that would require that consultation once the ophthalmologist had determined, or the optometrist had determined that a second medication would be required to control the glaucoma.
That's the reading that I think that is.
So that would be before, perhaps before the, you know, obviously not an expert in this, but before that's been tested and prescribed and.
Well, the current version would say if more than one medication is required, and that includes a combination. That's on the hand in.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Boswell.
You're right. Yeah.
And this one would say if more than two medications are required.
Yeah.
So with only two medications, it wouldn't require a consult.
Yeah. That's right.
Well, why don't you keep talking? And. And if we're at the point of impasse at this place, then we'll decide. We should. We haven't done the 8 yet, so I think that would be a useful thing. Nobody objects to the 8s.
Mr. Chair, I'd move the -8 amendments to House Bill, Senate Bill 656.
Any discussion? The -8. So now Senate Bill 656 is amended with the -4s and the 8s. And the discussion will be on the 9s, 10s, and 11s. Yes, some of them, or yes, the 11. And we'll just make that decision on Thursday and move fairly quickly with that. Thank you. Thank you guys for what all you do. Amanda, did you have something else?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I do want to say I think that Dr. Tibbles made it very clear we prefer one medication. We certainly won't withdraw support of the bill if you come to two medications.
No, I understand. We understand that. But, I mean, if you say okay to two, then we'll have to. If you say no, it should be one, then we'll have to figure out up here, which I think is all right. You've carried us a long way on this now, and I think we're willing to take the next step.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. I close the work session on Senate Bill 656. Anything else to come before the committee? Remember Thursday, bring your pajamas or at least plan on staying until 6. What have we got left? Excuse me. We've got 591,
34,
145.
34, 145.
Oops, 153 removed. You finished? Okay. 337, 591, 615. Oh, 614
removed today. 6 by 6 and 7.
Okay. I'm not convinced. Great. We ought to be able to make that. We're adjourned.